My name is Dee Bechtel, and the name of this session is Queers, Niggers, Cripples. Who is my brother? Who is my sister? I guess the other thing that we need to contend with today is the fact that it's a lovely day outside, and as I was heading for this session, I thought, oh, gee, it's terrible to talk about a subject that can be kind of depressing on a lovely day like this. But the other side of that coin is that it may be a lovely day here at Holden Village where we are all treated as children of God and can welcome each other in that spirit. But the fact is that we need to leave Holden, some of us soon and some of us maybe not for a few weeks, but we will need to go back out there to the real world where all is not so sunny if we happen to be of a different sexual lifestyle, of a different color, of a different race, sometimes of a different sex, and very commonly, if we happen to be of a different physical or mental handicap, then we're not always treated as equals and welcomed warmly in our churches or in society in general. Just basically as a background, there are, I'm sure you're aware, various classifications of people that the law tells us, the federal law in the United States tells us that we can't discriminate on some of these bases. You probably know them well. Sex, race, age, handicap, offer others.
Color, creed,
yes, or citizenship based on, you know, whether or not you are a citizen of the United States. Religion is one of those that we can't be discriminated against on the basis of our religious beliefs. In the development of this discrimination law, you may not be aware that sex was added kind of as an afterthought. And there are people who believe that the insertion of sex in that national law, that federal law, was added because of an attempt on the part of some people to try to get the bill so it wouldn't pass, to try to prevent passage of what's become now Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But I'm thankful that it did pass. Many of us are. Oh, incidentally, interrupt any time. Don't wait for me to ask you a question or to ask for your comments as we go along. Please feel free to interrupt and join in with your comments or questions. On the aspect of sex as a discriminating characteristic, I'd like to read to you a bit of a Supreme Court decision. I'll identify where it came from a little later. This quote says, "The civil law, as well as nature herself, has always recognized a wide difference in the respective fears and destinies of man and woman. Man is, or should be, woman's protector and defender. The natural and proper timidity and delicacies which belong to the female sex evidently unfit it for many of the occupations of civil life. The constitution of the family organization, which is founded in the divine ordinance, as well as the nature of things, indicates the domestic sphere as that which properly belongs to the domain and functions of womanhood. The harmony, not to say the identity of interest and views which belong or should belong to the family institution, is repugnant to the idea of a woman adopting a distinct and independent career from that of her husband." Now, this was a Supreme Court decision. It was dated December 1872, and the decision was that which concerned the right of Mrs. Myra Bradwell to practice as an attorney. She was denied the right to practice as an attorney in 1872 because she was a woman. Part of that decision had to do with the fact that she could not, as a woman, contract. It was illegal for her as a married woman, or her contracts were not valid, and so therefore it was assumed that any contract she made to represent anyone as a client would be invalid. and therefore her right to be admitted to practice law was denied. I'm glad to say we've come away since then in the terms of employment and discrimination, but I'm not sure some of us have come a long way in terms of the part of that decision that had to do with the divine right of things or the divine ordinance, as well as the nature of things. We still have a tendency to think things as they are or things as they were when we were growing up are the way they ought to be, and anyone who attempts to change our ideas is sometimes looked askance at, and sometimes, often, the churches don't do a whole lot in saying, yes, these people ought to be looked at as equals. There are, I'm sure you're aware, lots of different aspects of discrimination in our society, and certainly sex discrimination is not the only one. But I'm not sure all of us consider that it's still possible to discriminate a great deal in our society. We are not free from discrimination just because Title VII of the Civil Rights Act says that it's illegal to discriminate on various bases. One of those characteristics that we can still use to discriminate against people is sexual preference, or on the basis of whether or not a person is a homosexual. It is still perfectly legal to deny a person a job on the basis of the fact that that person is a homosexual. It is still perfectly legal to deny that person access to any public accommodations, such as a motel or even a movie theater. It's possible to deny a person a whole lot of things on the basis of the fact of their sexual preference. As a matter of fact, it's still possible and legal to deny people or to discriminate against people on a whole lot of other characteristics. In order to prevent someone from discriminating, you have to show that the basis for the discrimination is included in those very specifically enumerated characteristics. So if you can't, for instance, if a person is denied a job, and you can't show that the basis for denying that person a job was either sex, race, handicap, citizenship, age, those kinds of characteristics that are specifically mentioned in the law, it's legal. And that disturbs me a bit. It disturbs me in terms of the fairness, but it also disturbs me in terms of the fact that we are not always, maybe we are not often, ready to stand up as people within the protection of God's care and say it's wrong to discriminate. We have a lot of biblical base that says, for instance, the theme here, one body, many members. We're talking about including animals and all of nature in this inclusiveness. And that was a lot of the theme of a lot of the sessions that were happening last week. I would like to extend it this week to talk about other human beings that we may not be very comfortable in including in this inclusive love of God. Because of the way we have been brought up, sometimes it's very difficult for us to say, yes, I welcome someone who is a homosexual as an equal child of God. And as a matter of fact, for some of us, it's pretty difficult to even accept the Metropolitan Community Church, which is the church that homosexual people have formed, and it has branches or churches in many of our larger cities, at least, if not smaller cities. There are some people who call themselves Christians who say that that is abhorrent. There should not be a church for that proclaims itself as a homosexual church. But the fact is that there are a whole lot of people in our communities that don't feel very comfortable in the churches we go to. And so in order to worship God openly and in order to be themselves as full children of God, and loved by God as much as I am, they feel more comfortable in a separate church. I think that's a sad comment, but I'm not sure I see much hope for it changing, because I know it's very difficult for people, many of the people that I know, to accept a person when they find out that that person is a homosexual. I was pleased not too long ago to read a transcript of a speech by Sonia Johnson. Now, I'm not sure all of you know, recognize the name Sonia Johnson, but Sonia Johnson is a current day heretic. She is a person who was excommunicated from the Mormon Church because of her active support of the Equal Rights Amendment. And in this speech, she told a story of herself appearing on some sort of a television interview in Boise, Idaho. And she said after this television appearance, a young man who was a cameraman came up to her and was just so amazed. Apparently, in her telling of the story, she said she thought she was probably the first heretic that he had ever met face up. And he said, he was just so amazed, he said, "But you're just a mom." That's the whole point, friends. Heretics may be just moms, and homosexuals may be just people. People whose skin is darker than mine, and whose eyes are a different color than I am, than mine are, and whose ancestors may have come from a different part of the world than Northern Europe, are still just people. They have the same insides that I do, and they are hurt in the same way when I treat them as less than people. And I think it's my job as a Christian to accept them for everything that they're worth. And I think this extends even more and even more dramatically to people that have physical, and even more so to mental, handicaps. In some of the discussions in the sessions last week, people were telling stories about having real problems about acceptance in the church when, well, one person was telling a story about her husband had mental illness. And the response that she got from the church, apparently there were some people in her church that said, went to the pastor and said, "What should we do? How should we talk to this person? What should we say to this person? How do we treat the fact that her husband has just been admitted to a mental hospital?" And the pastor's advice was, "Well, it's probably a very sensitive subject for her, so if you just ignore it, that will be the best way to handle it." Wrong. That was the worst thing that people could have done to this woman, because she wanted the support, she wanted the help, she wanted to know that people in her church congregation felt her hurt and at least allowed her to talk about it so that she could tell them how she was feeling and they could be supportive of her. But by ignoring the problem, we are ignoring and covering up the hurt. And there's a whole lot of hurt in those kinds of situations. What she wanted from her congregation was support and love, and them just probably to hold her and hug her and say, "Tell me how it is," or "Just let me be with you." Some of the other biblical support that we can find for this inclusive attitude that I'm contending that we need to have in our churches are the quotes about, "We are neither slave nor free, neither man nor woman, we are all one in Christ." Well, if we are truly all one in Christ, then we need to accept other people as we want to be accepted. Now, I realize, and I think all of us realize, that we can't legislate attitudes. Just by passage of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, we can't automatically guarantee that all of our attitudes toward people who are different than we are going to change. But the best way I know to change is to actually or at least to be open to change, is to allow yourself to have an encounter with a person who is different than you are. One of my very favorite stories is about my mother, and I can tell it on her because it has a wonderfully happy ending. I grew up in a family in a very lily-white neighborhood, in a very lily-white school system, and I really had no early encounters, even through college, as I recall, with people whose skin was even rather slightly darker than mine, and certainly not with blacks. And I recall vividly family discussions when I was probably about in high school, in which my mother's attitude was, black people are fine in their place. And that was probably a rather common attitude at that time. It may be a common attitude now in our society too, but it may not be articulated as often or as freely as it was then. And according to my mother, black's place was certainly not living in her neighborhood, and the place of blacks was definitely not dating any of her daughters. But thanks be to God, when my mother moved to a different place, she was involved through Church Women United in a program where she went as a volunteer to a Job Corps center. And lo and behold, this was a men's Job Corps center, and she met some very fine black men. And that was just fine. You know, we were all just standing around at Christmas time when we gathered together with our mouths hanging open because Mother was telling us these wonderful stories about these people that she had met there and that she was corresponding with after they left Job Corps and that she had worked with. She was a reading tutor, was her volunteer position there in Job Corps. But never was a word said about the fact that they were black, but she had pictures of them, you know, to show us these individuals. They had become individuals for her. They were not them any longer. And she got very easily out of the we against them kind of attitude because she had had a personal encounter with some individuals, and she could accept them as individuals. That, as far as I'm concerned, is the recipe that we all ought to try to follow in whatever way we can to learn to know and to accept people who are different than we are. Now, in some cases, maybe with homosexuals, for example, we don't have to try very hard because sometimes, maybe often, there are homosexuals within our congregations, within our workplaces, that we don't know. It's very easy for a homosexual, well, easy in one aspect, I guess, for a homosexual to not reveal that fact if they don't choose to. On the other hand, having talked to some homosexuals who have had the courage to come out of the closet, it's very hard to hide that fact because we're saying to them, you can't really be you. You can't tell me all there is to know about you. And I can't accept you as you are because I can't accept the fact that you're a homosexual. So it's hard in that way for the person who has not come out of the closet. But the amazing thing is, the statistics are, as I understand them, is that probably 1 out of 10 people in our society is a homosexual. Well, if we look around the room and count, friends, you know, we may be here. And it may not be them against us. It may be people we know. And what they would like most for us to do is just to be so accepting of them as a human being that they have the freedom to tell us everything about themselves. Some of the other handicaps, social handicaps, I guess, maybe more obvious, obviously when a person, or usually anyway, when a person is a black, it's obvious to us just because of their appearance. And for those folks who are obviously different than we are, we can easily go up and just simply start up a conversation with them. Now, I say just simply. Sometimes that isn't the easiest thing to do, and I know it takes a lot of courage. But I would really encourage you to set up situations if there are people that you work with or people that you go to school with, or praise be the Lord, if there are people in your churches who are different and who might fall into some of these kinds of categories, it's our job to do whatever we can to make them feel that we are their friends. We are accepting of them, whatever their mental, physical, racial, whatever status might be. And I suspect our lack or our hesitancy to do those sort of things are really based a lot in our own fear. We are not sure. I guess we're afraid that they might get to be human beings to us, and we're not sure we want that to happen. Or in the area of homosexuals, I think a lot of our fear is that we're going to be attacked by them in some way. They're going to be sexually attracted to us, and we don't want that to happen because we're not really sure enough about our own sexuality in order to maybe admit that we might be attracted to a homosexual person, and that's really scary. I know that, or I understand that a lot of some men's fear of homosexual people is because they may have had unpleasant experiences in the past, and so they generalize that to, therefore, all homosexuals are going to make a pass at me, and that's really scary to me. The statistics are, in terms of, for instance, child abuse, that there are more incidences of heterosexual child abuse by a large majority than there are of homosexual child abuse. So the fear that some of us have that homosexual teachers, for example, are going to be attacking our children in the classroom, or that homosexual teachers are going to be unduly influencing our children to be homosexuals, are groundless. There is no basis for that at all, because obviously someone who has a job as a teacher is there because they're interested in teaching children. There's no greater chance, and certainly a far less chance, that a homosexual teacher is going to be out of line in any way with children than a heterosexual teacher, just because they value their job so much more than a heterosexual teacher may. Do you have any comments? I'm feeling very lonely at all this thing. Do you want to say something as we're going along? Right, yeah, and I understand what you're saying, too, about the business about not wanting to be a reverse bigot of some kind, you know, not wanting to particularly seek out people who are different than we are just because they are different. But somebody has to take the first step. I think that was the main point of the woman's story whose husband was in a mental hospital. Ignoring the differences is not the answer. That doesn't help. One of the ways that our laws in the past, of course, have dealt with the discrimination kind of situation is by setting up laws having to do with affirmative action. And it's real distressing to me now to see affirmative action decisions that have been made in the past being reversed, because I think that's a real danger. I know affirmative action programs have really set up an artificial kind of situation. They have forced us, for instance, forced employers to seek out, to do the kind of reverse bigotry that Don was talking about, in order to seek out specifically people who were in particular categories in order to fulfill affirmative action quotas. But the effect of those has been to give people who were in these categories that had been discriminated against in the past a leg up, and to get them onto positions, or well, first into job markets and then into positions of seniority more rapidly to make up for all the discriminating that we've done in the past. And now the problem is that under current decisions that are coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court, these affirmative action guidelines are really being seriously weakened. For example, there was one recently that said that when the economic situation worsened and there were not funds available, I think it was a fire department or a police department or something of that, some public employment, and the funds were cut back because of the economic situation, then it was okay to fire the last people that were hired. So that these people, even though they had been hired under affirmative action guidelines to fulfill quotas, they were the most recent hires and therefore they could be fired first. Well, this is really doing a lot of damage because it's saying then that we can use economic reasons to undermine the progress that we're making then in remedying past discrimination. And my fear is that the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court and probably the future makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court is tending in that more conservative bent. It's saying that economics are more important than affirmative action programs, and that's the basic trade-off that is happening now. That's distressing to me, and I'm not sure what any of us can do about it other than to make it clear to our elected representatives that we would like to see affirmative action strengthened in some way. There's not a whole lot that we can do to change the minds of 9 people on the Supreme Court. Another distressing development that's happening recently has to do with the rights of the mentally handicapped. We had been making progress, in my opinion, in terms of mainstreaming, for example, all handicapped kids, including mentally handicapped kids, into regular classrooms. And many of our school systems have been setting up programs that helped mentally handicapped kids as well as physically handicapped kids to develop as much potential as they're capable of. This same kind of things have been happening in terms of development of sheltered workshops and other living situations, for instance, group homes and those sorts of things that were available to mentally handicapped adults that could allow them to develop their own full potential. However, there was a statement recently, or it was in a legal brief, I believe, put out by the Justice Department, where they wrote a brief on one side of a case that was becoming before the Supreme Court, that held the position that what the mentally handicapped adults have is a right, quote, to freedom from unreasonable bodily restraints. And that's the extent, in terms of this Justice Department opinion, of the rights of the mentally handicapped. That is contrasted to the right to have as much independence as possible, or to develop to the full extent of a person's potential. Basically, what this Justice Department is saying is that all these mentally handicapped people have the right to do is not to be chained up in an institution. And that's really scary as far as I'm concerned, because again, we're looking at people who are different than I am because their mental processes may be different or may be less quick or have less potential than mine, but that doesn't mean that they're not a whole person and don't have the right, as much as I do, or as much as any of us do, to go as far as we can, or to get as much education as we can, or to get the best kind of job that allows us to be fulfilled as a human being. And if all we're saying then is we're going to be putting mentally handicapped people back in institutions and warehousing them and not allowing them to be full human beings just because it's cheaper to do that, again, we're really trading off dollars for some human beings' potential. And some of the ads on TV have been telling us, in support of the Negro College Fund, for example, that a mind is a terrible thing to waste. That same thing is true, in my opinion, in terms of mentally handicapped. Maybe the mind may not be as developed as some of ours, but it is still a mind, and it is still a human being that we're talking about.
Dee, if I could elaborate on that a little bit about the mainstreaming. When probably not Law 94-142 came into being, the intent of the law was to have mainstreaming for all children in the United States. And what happened with that, again, was the result of all our own bias and prejudice. It's just so ingrained and widespread that the average school district in the United States followed the law in letter but not in spirit, which means that they did mainstream these children, but they did not provide the kind of support that they needed to provide. In other words, they didn't provide the kind of help for the teachers. They put these children in situations expecting a classroom teacher to not only teach her whole class, but then to try to help someone who needed extra help. And they weren't supporting. We happen to be very blessed in being in a school district that really is a sample for the entire nation. It has followed the letter and spirit of the law and provides these little children a classroom mainstreaming situation with an aide. In the case of our daughter, she has a full-time aide. Sometimes when they're older, they have maybe one aide for three children if they're, you know, able to do that. But anyway, all of the United States has had it happen. And so there was a law that was put through, and as a writer on the law, they tried to repeal that mainstreaming part of 94-142 simply because the teachers all over the country are screaming.
Yeah, I can understand why it's a real burden for a teacher.
It's criminal, you know, and it really makes me angry. But again, it just goes back to our own lack of commitment. School districts all over the country lack of commitment to handicapped people for the reasons you've been talking about.
Yeah. I can understand why a teacher who has 30 children already in a classroom would be a little upset when the school district administration is saying, now on top of these 30 children that you need to spend your time with, you also have maybe two or three or maybe even one handicapped child. That's a lot of extra burden for a teacher to handle, and I can understand that the teacher, right, because that child, that special child, needs some extra assistance. And so
she's
what it takes again.
Teacher, but she's the child a lot too.
Sure, yeah. Again, what it comes down to is what's more important, bucks or individual people? Because it takes extra money then from school districts to pay an aide, for example, or to do whatever. In some cases, it takes a lot more bucks in our churches simply to put in a ramp for the handicapped so that people in wheelchairs or people on crutches can get into your sanctuary. I can't remember what session I was in last week where somebody gave an example of this wonderful ramp that they put up to this building in order to make it handicapped accessible. And at the top of the ramp, before the door, there were two steps. Doesn't make any sense. And I know it's difficult for some of us who worship in old church buildings that the architecture says, you know, it was wonderful to put 32 steps up before the front door or whatever, you know. It gets to be a real problem then. What do? Do you find a way to put in an elevator? How do you handle this? How do you make it accessible to the handicapped? But I think it's important that we wrestle with questions like that. I think it's important that we consider in each of our individual lives, how do we make the first step to go up and talk to somebody who may be different than we are? How do we make them feel welcome? How do we let them know that we are accepting them as children of God? And I think maybe the step that comes before that, of course, is to struggle with our own attitudes, to say, how do I feel about someone who is homosexual? Am I really afraid of someone whose lifestyle may be different than mine? Can I accept that person as a whole human being?
Excuse me. Yeah. I come from a family that is discriminated in more than one way. Mm-hmm. There are 4 children in the family, and I'm the second oldest, and 3 of them are adopted. I'm the only natural one. My older brother is 16, and last October, I think it was just put into a mental hospital for attempting suicide many times, and thank God not succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
My 2 younger brothers and sisters, I have a sister who's 10 and a brother who's 8, were born in South America in a place called Cali, and we adopted them there. Not only are they discriminated for being from another place, but also being a different color than the rest of everyone else. And my family also lived in South America for 7 years. And when we lived there, then I was the minority. I was the one who was discriminated. And so I know how it feels. Not to criticize the way people in the United States are, but when I lived in South America, I found that even though I was a minority by quite a bit, the people did still come up to me and talk to me and open up and were very, really friendly. More than I found they are here to my brother and sister there. They turned the cold shoulder onto me more than I was given the cold shoulder in that country. And I find that hard to deal with, especially them being my relatives and everything. And sometimes get into arguments, even with some of my friends, over the race and, the way my brother and sister look, and my older brother being in the hospital now.
Do you have some suggestions then for the rest of us? How can we make the situation better?
I think that just accepting them the way they are, I practically put out of my mind that my brother and sister are a different color.
Sure.
They speak English fluently. They do not know Spanish at all. I know Spanish better than they do. I know the language fluently, and they don't. The only reason that they really get discriminated against is because they have fairly dark skin. It's quite dark. And black hair. And they really get discriminated against because of that. I don't notice it anymore. I've lived with them for a long time now, 5-6 years, so I don't notice it. It has nothing to do with it. I think just love the person the way they are. It doesn't matter what they look like to me or whether they're in a hospital or not. Mm-hmm. It really makes no difference whatsoever to me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other comments?
I think sometimes when you have someone in the family who's different, you feel a little concerned, as I'm sure your parents have for your other children, just because you don't know what they're going to face. If they're going to face, the day is bound to come when someone makes a comment to one of our other children. It's me, who's regarding the child is different. I had someone ask me who was a member of the family, in fact, one time if Megan was going to be a little bit slow too because of having a retarded sister.
Just like being retarded is catching somehow, huh?
It's just amazing. But it is hard as a parent. You do worry a little bit about that. But the other side of that is just hearing this girl talk too, is that your children are so enriched, and she has been enriched by you've been deepened and enriched so much by having to experience that at such a young age. And I think that our children are going to be, a lot richer and a lot wiser than the average child just because of this experience.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, for instance, my son has gone to school ever since the time that he was in preschool with a child that I'm not sure if he has what the name of his disease is. Anyway, he has trouble with the lower half of his body. He can't walk without crutches and those sorts of things. Anyway, this child has been in the public schools and in the same age group with kids of his own age since the time that he was in preschool. And that's been a real assistance, I think, to my son, who has been with this boy in several different classes, and just simply by experiencing him as just another kid in the class. He may not be able to do some of the things that other kids do, but on the other hand, there are things that he can do better than some of the other kids. And so just accepting him as a person with strengths and weaknesses like all of us have, I think, has enriched my son. And I think that's the kind of experience that we all can open ourselves to, rather than being afraid of what will other people say. We can simply experience the richness of another human being. And that's the important thing to keep in mind. That's scary, but it gets easier as we go along.
And you know, that's the wonderful thing about mainstreaming, is that the people in here who have children or grandchildren, you know, they are so fortunate because they're growing up now finding out that that little boy in a wheelchair who can't communicate verbally is still a person with a personality, and they get sensitive to him and find out that he smiles and laughs and jokes and understands. Mm-hmm. You know, and whereas us as adults, since we didn't have that opportunity as children, we still feel shy around the handicapped people. They don't, and it's the same way with my little girl, you know, she has classmates, they just, and it's wonderful to think our world could be that way.
Yes.
And the whole, you know, when they did the mainstreaming thing, it was for the handicapped people, it wasn't for all the other people in there.
Yes, right. It's a benefit from all of us because it's teaching us all attitudes about people who are different than we are. It's the same principle under which racial segregation was outlawed. It's the same kind of thing, that separate is not equal, that the only way we can be equal is to be together. And that sometimes leads us into tough questions about busing and things that may be uncomfortable for all of us, but we still need to remember that in order to truly be equal, we need to be encountering people who are different than we are, because we are enriched by them.
I think the way that has been brought home to me in most ways, dealing with it with regard to my own family. I have a daughter who's a Regents Scholar at UCSB and has now come out of the closet. She's a lesbian, and I've had to deal with it. Mm-hmm. I also have a son who was on LSD and spent some time in CYA camps. So I think it's based on your dealing with it within a family. Now, maybe not your immediate family, but how you respond to close friends or whatever, close family, I think then allows you to respond to others. I don't think that's what you're saying, because you know your family, you can accept, because I know some people who are not accepted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that our churches can become that extended family, that we can come out of the closet with whatever our differences are within our church family and feel accepted and loved in that family, because then the whole church family learns too. And I know that's difficult to do if some of our churches are really large, but there are ways to do it. There
also,
are ways.
What is the American Lutheran Church's statement? Didn't it come out rather recently in the last couple of years about homosexuality? I remember being confused by that and having trouble.
I don't know, and I am not a Lutheran, so I don't know. So, I know that the Presbyterian tradition is the one that I come from, and there was a great deal of pain that went on in the Presbyterian Church within the last few years on the issue of ordaining people who were avowed homosexuals. And I regret to say that the position of the Presbyterian Church nationally is that if a person admits that they are homosexual, they will not be ordained. And I think that's a crime, because what we're saying, what my church is saying to these people is, it's okay to be that, just don't tell me about it.
Methodist just took a stand like that, too.
And well, what was their stand?
I mean, I think their stand was, I just read the headlines and so forth, but it had something to do with the position that they took against homosexuality.
I recall reading headlines. I don't know what the position was. Do you know more?
No. I'm a Lutheran, so I didn't pay that much attention.
Does anyone know more about the Lutheran statement?
I don't know if it's really been resolved yet. I think they're still got it tossed up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real definite thing come out where they're saying that this is how we stand on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very involved issue, and I think it's going to take, I mean, it's going to really take some, at that level, we're talking national.
Yes.
It's going to take some real thinking on their part and a lot of input from people on how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of that's going to have to deal with people's feelings and how their church reacts to things.
Yes.
I want to make a comment, though, about your racial issue type of a deal. I come from a very large family, and I come from a my grandparents were members of Pancho Villa's gang, so we were like outlaws way back when. it's interesting because some of the comments, especially the comment that the young lady made up there, that kind of hits home for me at least, because my father's very quiet, very very Latin. Doesn't say anything when he speaks, he listens and obey. Mothers were the ones that had the ruling hand. I learned a lot of my parents just recently, having sat down and talked to them about how it was when they grew up. And it was interesting. My father, at 11 years old, 13 years old, was working on the railroad. And I thought about that for a long time. I mean, there's no way I could physically do that. This guy was 11 years old. I admired my dad when he told me that, that he never finished high school and that he wanted to go back to school, and he did. I'm proud of him. Finally got his high school diploma in 1975, I think it was. He was like 56 years old. My mother was the same thing too. She, being Hispanic, they had a hard time getting jobs in the United States. So my dad basically took anything he could get, railroad, you know, picking vegetables, San Joaquin Valley, that type of thing. My mother, on the other hand, was very fortunate. Her parents died when she was relatively young, and her aunt took her in, never adopted her, but took her in and raised her basically in a more traditional Spanish way than I guess she was accustomed to. But they knew that one of the things that was important was a business sense to survive. So my grandfather, who was a cabinet maker, we'll say my grandfather, I only know him as my grandfather, but he was really my mother's uncle, taught her business sense. And my mother did quite well. She went, they sent her to business school back east, and she graduated from there. And she got lucky, she got in with an oil man, and showed her a vast amount of information about what really goes on in the world and things like that. And my mother learned something really, really about her age, was that, and it's sort of what they have passed on to me, and sort of what I take to heart, that we as a minority, in a general sense, have to learn the white man's way, and then we have to turn around to survive. And what's happened to me is that my parents have sent me to the finest schools, and they've paid thousands and thousands of dollars to send me to the finest. I've basically been raised as an Anglo-Saxon. My values are Anglo-Saxon. Everything about me is an Anglo-Saxon. I was in college, and I wanted to learn something about my roots and things like that, and I went into a class of basically predominantly Hispanic, and was really ridiculed because of the way I think, because of the type of education that I've had, and because of the background that I come from. It was not their style. So I got discriminated from my own kind, if you want to use that term, and at the same time I'm being discriminated from the other side because I'm a different color, because my skin's a different color because of tradition and things like that. Mm-hmm. So really, I'm in a unique position, and I'm very grateful for that, because I can see both sides of the road. Mm-hmm. And I can see when it comes down to the busing issue, I was out there campaigning, because I knew how I felt about it. I'm very active in Latin-type organizations. I'm very active. I sit on the board of directors on the alumni board. I keep my spotlight in the eyes of my peers, because I want them to know that just because I am the skin of just because my color of my skin is different from yours, does not mean that my mind is any different from yours. Does not mean that I cannot compete with you on your level. Mm-hmm. Don't put me in a situation that I'm not as good as you or that I'm better than you. All I want is an opportunity to prove to you that I can do a just as well a job as anybody else can. And that's what the main point of a lot of things that are going on is that we have to take that risk. We have to take that gamble. We have to stretch our hand out and ask, can I help you to some degree?
and let that person prove themselves, not necessarily prove themselves, let that person show you what they know and show you what they can do. And if you can at least extend their hand and further their enhancement, then by all means do that. I do that tremendously with some of the organizations that I'm involved in, because I'm trying to set an example for the smaller children who don't have, shall we say, that figure to look up to, because predominantly statistically show that most Latin people's parents are basically bricklayers, or cooks, or there are very few whose parents are attorneys, there are very few whose parents are doctors, and basically they need those role models. If you came from a family whose parent was a doctor or a nurse or something like that, they had that guidance to show you. My parents didn't show me any guidance, basically. They just said that we know you have to learn something other than what we have, and we know you can do it, and we know you can have a better life than what we have. And so basically they said the only way to do that is to send you to schools that will teach you that.
Yeah. The problem that I see in what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying, it's true, but I see a parallel with the women's movement, too,
definitely.
That there's a danger in learning the white man system, and I think it is a white man system, and then being so enmeshed in it that you're not as eager to change that system. And I think racial minorities and women need to be active about changing that system so the system isn't so oppressive to the next generations coming along.
I recently read a book by Andrea Bjork, who's a pretty radical feminist, who was saying that equal rights is not what we want. In a patriarchal society, there's a great deal of injustice that exists, and we don't want to be equal to that. We want to be better than that.
Yes.
And I think I'm a little bit troubled by the attitude that, okay, you need to see this person as a person and get to know this person and then make a judgment of it. Talking about homosexuals, or talking about Hispanics, or blacks, or the handicapped, or whatever, in that when a white person in a predominantly white society hears that, it's almost as if, well, okay, let's let those people prove themselves to you, that they have to earn it. It's really kind of a slight, subtle attitude, but I think it's a very strong one. And I think maybe the Good Samaritan is a better model, where the person doesn't bother to ask, well, you know, what good are you, or what provides a word for which I should help you, but rather just gives with love or hate.
The point that you made earlier too about just loving them.
Well, a footnote to that too, there's a Los Angeles Times won a Pulitzer Prize for an article they ran just recently, over last year, I guess, or this year, but earlier in the year. They did a 2 or 3 week sequence on, and the Latin Americans, or the Latinos is what they called it, in Southern California. And what basically they were showing the different cultures that a lot of the Latin American people come from, whether it be from the poor sector, from the middle class, upper class, showing how successful some are in business and industry, how successful some aren't, showing all Los Angeles the culture that is predominant in Los Angeles. And once they started to understand the culture, it was easier for some people, I won't say all, easier for some people to accept them. Because basically to accept somebody, you have to know what their background is, and you can draw parallels to your life so you can communicate with them, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for coming.